Rebecca, I have an email from a patron who wants to know once and for all if therapists actually care about their clients.
Mm.
So I thought we would read that email, and then you and I could have a conversation about is it genuine? Is it fake? What do you say? Do you want to talk about that?
I'm up for it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Bloom. I'm a licensed mental health counselor in Seattle, Washington.
You have a private practice in Columbia City?
I have a thriving private practice in the ultimately hip neighborhood of Hillman City, Washington.
Which is just south of Columbia City, correct? Because no one knows where Hillman City is.
I know. I always say, have you ever gone to Seward Park? Have you gotten there on Rainier? And then they're like, yeah. And I'm like, you know where you turn off Rainier? Yeah. Well, that's Hillman City. So.
Is it also called Genesee? I call that Genesee.
No. Oh. I don't even know where Genesee is.
Oh, Genesee Avenue is that, or street, is that street that comes off Rainier and goes toward
That's a
lake.
Different neighborhood, actually.
So is that north of Hillman City?
You turn there. Fascinating. I never knew this about you.
Well, no. I mean, I'm just saying that I turn there if I'm going, like, to where the races are.
Oh, yes.
But the Seward Park is further. So you're actually – well, I guess why don't you just say your practice is in Seward then? Because that's probably what
– Because technically Seward is a little fancier.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean – when I lived in Lake City, I technically lived in Olympic Hills, but no one knows where Olympic Hills is. But I never said I lived in Olympic Hills. I said I lived in Lake City, but I didn't actually live in Lake City. You know what I'm saying?
I hear you.
It's sort of like people who live in Crown Hill will say they live in Ballard. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I enjoy saying Hillman City just because it's got a new piece of Hillman City pride going on, and we've got fun stuff over here. And, you know, I'm always up for a little bit of a discussion with people.
Right now, 99.9% of our listeners are bored out of their mind. But
they can't. They just wish we'd shut up.
But those two listeners who live in Hillman City, Columbia City, Seward,
they're feeling
Genesee,
pride.
They're all just like, oh, my God, they're talking about my neighborhood in Seattle. All right. This is a email from patron Amy. She writes, do therapists actually care or are they pretending? I can't figure you guys out. My therapist triggered my PTSD on accident. It scared the crap out of me. And now I have an urge to terminate therapy. But it's my pattern to cut and run in situations like this. And I'm trying to challenge myself to stick with him and work on it. But I'm worried that he's only in it for the money. Rebecca, what do you think?
Well, we're not making enough money to be only in it for the money. I gotta tell you. We're not Amazon software engineers. I mean, I actually care about people getting better, and I know the incredible value of people's, even in one individual's mental health. I've seen it impact a whole family system, a community. I've seen that person go off to do great things. So sometimes, I'll be honest, I don't care about the individual person, their individual story, their individual problem on that day. For whatever reason, I don't have it in me. But in general, I care about people and I care about the state of our world. How's that?
Does that manifest in the sort of caring that patron Amy is writing about? You know, she's asking, do therapists actually care about, do you think patron Amy's therapist actually cares genuinely about patron Amy?
You know, I would hope so, but I think the idea of like care can be really different for different people.
Yeah.
You know, for some clients, my clients feel incredibly cared for because I have an uncanny ability to recall events and put what they're saying in the context of something that came up, you know, 25 sessions ago. That's just how my brain works. Not every therapist works like that. Some therapists love every single client and, you know, they feel that warm paternal, maternal like energy off of that person. And that's what that client feels is love.
Right.
I mean, I think it's so different for each person of like, what is love? This is a song.
It's true.
So, you know, not, and that's why not every therapist is a fit with every client. If you need that constant warm mommy energy, I'm not the right therapist for you. If you need a therapist who can track your incredibly complicated family history and bring something up from 2 years ago and tell you that it's connected to what you're talking about today, I'm the perfect therapist for you.
Yeah, so, I'm glad you're responding this way because that was my sense of you. I think it takes, I think, some amount of bravery to admit what you're saying. I don't think what you're saying is bad, but what I'm saying is I think some people maybe not as confident in their style of therapy would really want to emphasize that they super, super care about all their clients as if they were family members or something. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was my sense of your style of therapy was that it's how you're describing it. And I think, I mean, was there a time in your career when you cared more or less?
Well, I would actually say my training allowed us not to love every client. In fact, we were told we would not love every client, and we might be repulsed by every client. And I think that the way it really depends on where you were trained. I mean, I think I've seen way more on the West Coast that people are trained, you know, that positive regard for every client is, you know, what we do, and we are an advocate for every client. And so I was actually just in a training this weekend, and I could feel the tension. I wanted to talk about what was annoying, and there was like Zippo room in the room from my way of thinking, which isn't atypical for me. I mean, I experience that a lot. So, yeah, it is hard to know that you don't have to love your clients all the time to work with them. But I think it's important from the work because that love ebb and flows. And anyone who's out there who's a parent knows exactly what I'm talking about. You don't love your child every moment of every day, but I'm there for my child every moment of every day.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, my answer to patron Amy is, in general, in a broad sense of caring, yeah, absolutely. Most therapists, if not all, truly, genuinely care about their clients. I would say that if they didn't care, they would burn out of the profession very quickly.
Mm-hmm. And that's
go ahead.
And on the flip side, that's why a lot of people do burn out so quickly, is that they try and care and love every client.
Right. So there's totally a balance of not caring too much and but having some enthusiasm and care and compassion for clients and genuine caring about improvement, as you were putting it earlier. Because one, as you were saying earlier, if you didn't care about your clients, there are so many other ways to make money given a master's degree and given enough dedication to a career path. And so part of the reason why people become therapists is because they deeply care about other human beings and actually want humans to have improvements in their life or be stripped of oppression or whatever it is. So there's that. And also, if you don't care, the amount of stress that the job puts you through, if you don't care about your clients, you're going to have a hard time justifying all of that stress, particularly in the beginning of your career. So I would say in general, yeah, most if not all therapists really care. Plus, therapists tend to be on the caring, compassionate side of the spectrum in general. That's why they became, that's why people said you should be a therapist or something like that. But as I think you're talking about, Rebecca, there's a spectrum. Some people care more than others, and some therapists care in different ways. And some people have different training and different modalities about what caring actually means. And for myself, I absolutely do care about my clients. for instance, I worry about them. Not a lot, but I, you know, I will. I wish the best for them. I empathize with them. I work hard to help them. When they come in to my office, I'm genuinely interested in hearing what's, you know, going on in their life. I love my job and I love talking to my clients, and I'm never looking at the clock, or very rarely, let's just say, at least not in my current client load. I don't, there's no one where I'm like, God, I can't wait for this session to be over. So, you know, those are all, I would say, evidences that I actually care. But on the other hand, these are clients. They're not my family members. For instance, if they suddenly terminated with me, which many clients do, not because they hate me, but that's just generally how people terminate. They tend to just sort of drift away. And I generally don't get upset. Or on the off chance that a client hates me, just hates my guts, which happens pretty rarely, but it, you know, it'll happen. I don't get very upset about it. There's a professional distance between me and my clients, and it's necessary for me to keep my sanity. I mean, imagine if I considered all my clients in the same way regarding caring that I do my family members. The grief of losing all those people would just be tremendous, and the pain of witnessing difficulty and the pain of their occasional criticism of me would be tremendous. I did a back of the napkin calculation before we started recording, and over my career, I think I've had 5,000-ish individual clients, because I'm a couple and family therapist, so every client, every other client is a multiple group of people.
Great.
And so, you know, but at the very least, like for yourself, because you're more individual, right? You see more individual clients, right?
Yeah, but I did group work for years also. So
thousands of people, let's just put it that way. And if I deeply, deeply cared about them the way that I did about family members, then I would have probably, you know, killed myself long ago from just all the grief of not being able to talk to them anymore. So there's a professional distance, but caring, I can, in session, while they're sitting in front of me, it doesn't take much for me to access my compassion and my positive regard and all that kind of warm West Coast love that I think you were referring to earlier. I can access that pretty easily. But as soon as the session is over, it doesn't linger, you know? Mm-hmm. I can sit with someone and be present and listen and care, and their life could be in shambles. Their life could be coming apart at the seams. And I'm concerned about them. I'm worried about them. But at this point in my career, and maybe probably 10 years into my career, it became this way. As soon as the session is over, then it doesn't linger beyond that. I don't ruminate or wonder what's happening or want to reach out to them. It's genuine in the moment, I don't want to say I put it aside when they walk out the door. It's just like it's in the moment, here and now, genuine stuff. And then when they leave my office, they leave my office. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, you have to be able to let it go. And that is one of the bizarre parts of our work. Like, I have a client who has major suicide ideations and has attempted suicide in the past. And it's a legal case, and I'm consulting with other people. And, I've had to have a lot of really intense conversations with this person. They've decided to voluntarily go into partial hospitalization. If they were my family member, I would be calling them every day.
Right.
But they're my client. And so I just have to trust that they're going to walk out the door and be okay.
Right.
And that's one of the crazy pieces of our work.
Yeah.
And so I think if you haven't ever been in our work, it's hard to know what it's like to sit, to have those kind of boundaries, or this is what we call, you know, holding the frame.
And that's a common thing for novice therapists to seek help with, which is not common, I would say universal, the feeling of, oh my God, these people are coming to me for help. And especially at internship, because these people tend to get the most difficult cases around, ironically or paradoxically. And these therapists are overwhelmed. They think therapy takes a very short amount of time. They feel this tremendous responsibility, and they are overwhelmed with their caring for the client. And a big part of my supervision with them is to help them to work their ass off when they're in session.
Mm-hmm.
And if
or not even.
Yeah, work their ass reasonably off in session. But and if there's a task to perform outside of the session, like contacting a collateral contact or writing a note, then by all means, you know, put energy into that. But if there's not anything like that, which there often isn't, then as soon as the session is over, then that's it. You have to find a way of caring and worrying when you're there. But as soon as the session is over, unless the caring and worrying is for a purpose of some sort, then you just have to figure out a way of having that be put aside, so you're not bogged down and traumatized by all that. And as I say this, I think in a way, and tell me what you think about this, it's almost like a different form of love for me. It's almost because there's not a lot of loves that are like this. I guess it's the sort of love you would have for someone that you know you're only going to talk to for a little bit of time. Like you're on the airplane and you're on a 6-hour flight and there's this grandma next to you and you strike up a conversation and you're just like, I really like this person. But as soon as the flight is over, you get your bags from the overhead bin and you walk away, and you know, you're not going to, in all likelihood, you're not going to talk to that person again. But in that moment, you absolutely cared and were enamored by them and respected them and were interested in them. And you'll never forget that conversation, but you're not clamoring for ongoing attachment with that person. I feel like we tend to categorize love and attachment and caring and compassion within relationships that are at least hoped to last forever in some ways. And so this is like a different category of compassion and love. And I use the word love quite deliberately because, and again, this is my, you know, West Coast lovey-dovey tree hugger kind of way of thinking, but that is, I will in class use the word love. And if you were a student, I'd be driving you crazy, but I will say, because there's not another word for it in my mind that truly encapsulates the way that I feel toward my clients in the moment. The word love to me evokes what I think is what's actually happening. And so, but that's my style, right? And I actually get a lot of fulfillment by forms of therapy in which I, in my mind, linguistically associate what I'm doing with love. Not in the romantic sense, obviously, but in the, I don't know, just in the love your neighbor kind of way. Does that make sense? Am I too hippy dippy?
No, I've lived on the West Coast my whole life. I totally understand what you're saying.
You've been
I've been loved.
Well, what should patron Amy do? Let's close with that. She was triggered. Her therapist, male therapist, triggered her PTSD on accident. Really scared her, and she had an urge to terminate.
She should probably tell her therapist that.
Yeah. What should she say?
She should talk about her patterns and how they're about to repeat.
Yeah. Right. For the purpose of alerting.
Growing.
Yeah. For the purpose of alerting the therapist. One, it's growth to just say that to somebody, by the way, you know, and to have, but the key is in that conversation and in that triggering and in all that back and forth, the therapist will remain stable and attuned to you if the therapist is any good, which it sounds like he might be. And through those, through all those experiences of you being triggered and then you wanting to cut and run, but him being caring and you wondering if he cares and you asking if he cares, and he says, absolutely, I care. And he's not, he doesn't ridicule you for the question, or he doesn't reject you for asking the question, and you have a discussion about it. And through all that experience, it's a corrective experience because you are experiencing someone who cares, who doesn't run away and doesn't criticize, which is likely why you're in therapy in the first place. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. Well, yeah. That does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Patron Amy, let us know what you think about what we're saying. Perhaps some time has passed since you actually wrote this email, and so maybe some things have happened you could let us in on. That does it for that episode. Thanks for joining us. Please take care of yourself. Rebecca, why should people take care of themselves?
You know, speaking your truth is one of the most dynamic acts you can do. And so I was reminded RuPaul was nominated as top 100 most influential people by Time Magazine. And they gave a lovely speech about it. And their number one concern in their lives is self-love. So by taking care of yourself, you're practicing self-love.
Before closing, just occurred to me, do you remember in an episode we were talking about golden apples?
No.
The golden apple thing?
Remind me.
The apple award?
People who win a lot of awards, yeah.
They get a golden apple?
Yeah, they get a glass apple.
Oh, glass apple. They get a glass
apple. That's why I have no memory of what you were saying.
Okay, glass apple. So, have you seen these glass apples?
I am married to someone who receives a lot of glass apples.
What do they look? So my mom listens to this podcast, by the way. Mm-hmm. And she heard me say, I mean, I don't remember talking about this specifically, but I'm pretty sure I was being silly when I said,
you were being flippant.
How come I don't have an apple? You know what I mean? Well, my mom being the loving mom that she is, she was like, well, God, Kirk has to have an apple. I got to get him an apple. He seems like he really wants an apple. And so I don't know if it was on her mind or she actually sought it out, but she found a glass apple that was given to my grandmother.
Oh, that's cool.
Like in the 40s or 50s or 60s or something. And it's golden. It's a glass small apple, and it has liquid on the inside, and there are golden flakes of gold that are like a snow globe on the inside.
Oh,
and like Goldschlager. Have you ever had Goldschlager?
Yes, not drinking it, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, I think Goldschlager tastes like licorice. I think it's one of those black licorice tasting sort of liqueurs, but anyway, so she gave it to me, so now I have a glass apple. But I wanted to ask you, is it the same thing?
The glass apples I'm talking about are much lower quality, the type of thing that you would receive at an awards dinner. They probably cost minimal amounts to produce, but looks fancy from the stage.
Does it look crystal? I'm trying to imagine what
yes,
it looks like.
Yeah. Okay. It looks like a crystal apple.
Is it engraved or is it just
potentially, you know, it could
but
say
some
like
of them might not be.
Right. Like thanks for your hard work. You know, you're the best whatever in Washington State.
Okay.
We acknowledge that you've done XYZ.
And this is a Washington award culture or something.
I imagine in other states maybe you get a glass Buckeye. I don't know.
Or a glass peach. Or a glass corn husker, whatever the hell that is.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
A glass alligator.
Yeah, that was what, oh my God, I was going to say glass alligator. So now I have a golden apple. And so Rebecca, neener, 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 I'm pretty sure you don't have one.
I don't have a glass apple.
Now if your mom listens to this.
Which she doesn't.
Okay. Well, if she did, if she cared really about you, she would listen to this and she would get you a glass apple.
Which I think speaks to my attachment issues.
All right, well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us. Please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. Y'all deserve apples, especially you, Rebecca. You deserve. Now I got to get you an apple, pretty much.
Okay, that's find me a glass apple.
Yeah, okay.
And you're your own glass apple. I mean, at the end of the day,
you're your own glass apple.
You got to reach inside and find that glass apple.
And
say,
I am my own glass apple.
I am my own best glass apple.
I award myself with myself.
Right. I feel myself. I feel the goodness within myself.
This is starting to get sexual, but that's okay.
Goodness can come in lots of forms.
That's right.
And I am worthy of my own admiration. If I wait my whole life for someone else to give me that glass apple, it might never come.
Yeah. Well, fortunately for myself, I don't have to do that pep talk, because I actually have a glass apple. All right. Well, that does it. See ya.